I went out and got me a patent leather white jumpsuit and killer heels. I went into that audition with my stripper gear on, and I thought I was just too fine, okay? The casting director was Wendy Kurtzman, a kind and direct woman. I did my read-through, and she smiled. "It's a good thing you can act, dear," Wendy said. "Because that outfit? No." "But she's a stripper," I said, suddenly feeling much, much less too fine. "Dear, she's a stripper with a heart of gold," she said. "No nonsense. She strips for a living. Now, I want you to watch the movie Speed and study Sandra Bullock. That kind of look. You have to have that kind of feel to you. You can audition again." I'm so glad I stayed present and took the note not as criticism, but as an insight. She wanted me to succeed, and her comments were the tools I needed to do better. You can't swat away advice like that. Take it, consider it, and decide if it's something you need to hear. So I did my homework. I rented Speed that night, and I was like, oh, I get it now. And when I went back into that audition, I wore a cute summer dress, and I got me some little combat boots and ankle socks with lace on them. As soon as I walked in, Wendy said, "There you go. Now you understand." I had the look, but I still needed to get the role. In total, I had to audition 6 times. Finally, they called me and said, "Vivica, you got the part." I ran around my house screaming. They had been stuck so long on Jasmine, they needed me the very next day. It was like, boom. I'm racing around in a truck and jumping over stuff. They thrust me right in there. But I'd prepared. I knew every line and was ready. There was no excuses, and it's a good thing. Because the director, Roland Emmerich, told me a secret at the Independence Day premiere. "Did you know," he asked in his cute German accent, "that if you didn't do good on your first day of filming, that we were going to fire you?"
"Really?"
"Yeah, because there was one girl that was our first choice. Kristen Wilson," Roland said. "But she was doing a show with Montel Williams, so she was unavailable. Your first day of filming, they called and said, 'Okay, we'll work with your schedule. She's available now.'" Roland laughed at my look of shock. He'd clearly been sitting on this for a while. He said he and the producers immediately looked at my dailies. "Nope," he remembered them all saying, "she's right for Jasmine." My entire career was on the line that first day on the set, and I had no idea. You've got to show up and be present, because you never know who is watching you and deciding if you need a promotion or a job. When you're doing the work you love, not calling it in or just coasting along, you need to be on it every day. That's what makes a boss. Meanwhile, during filming, I thought the biggest pressure on me was my stripping scene. You know I took that seriously. I even got a stripper tutor. They found a local strip joint, and I met a stripper there at 9 o'clock in the morning when the place was closed. We had class every morning for a week, and a sister was strict, like she was doing freaking Juilliard for strippers. She gave me the ground rules the first day. "I want you to lose your inhibition," she said. "I want you to come in from now on in 4-inch heels. You can have shorts on, but I want you to wear a G-string underneath." "Okay," I said, in the meekest little church girl voice in the world. But I did it. Next time we met, she was still all business. "Take off the shorts and walk around," she said. "Let's get you comfortable parading around." "All right," I said. "Time to get comfortable being uncomfortable." She turned out to be the perfect teacher for me. By the time we were filming, they had this big bikini bottom thing ready for me to put on, and I was like, "Nope, I'm committed. G-string." She had made me so comfortable that I didn't even realize I would be on film walking in all ass out. At the premiere, I won't lie, I was like, whoa. My mom was shocked. "You had your butt all out there for all to see," she said. "But at least it's nice and tight." I also had a personal trainer named Will Smith. Yes, that one. Lord, he did not give me a break. We were filming in Wendover, Utah, which we all called Bendover, Utah, because it was such a small town that there was fuck all to do there. We were there 2 weeks, and early on, I had a couple of days off. They put us all up in this hotel, and I was hanging out by the jacuzzi, having a margarita. What else was there to do? Then Will walked by and did a double take. "What are you doing?" he said, as serious as a heart attack. Having a drink? It's my day off. "Vivica, come here," he said. "We are going upstairs and we are going to do push-ups and do weights. You have to realize this movie is going to be big. This movie is going to change our lives. It's important for us to show up and be good." Well, I put down a margarita. He was a tough taskmaster, but he was right. When you have the gift of an opportunity in your career, do everything you can to make the most of it. Don't let someone else work harder than you, because you will be handing them the keys to your dream. And yes, it was a big deal that here we were making a movie about two black people and a Jewish guy who saved the world. I would talk to Will about what that could mean for the African-American community, but he saw it as a bigger thing. "I don't want you to think of it that way," I recall him telling me. "You just have to be a strong woman, somebody that they don't look at based on your skin color." I got that. You know that I'm black and I'm proud, but I don't want to be seen solely for my color. People don't say Meryl Streep or Jennifer Lawrence are wonderful white actresses, and I'll leave it at that. Will was dating Jada Pinkett, who I thought was just fantastic. They met when she auditioned for Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but they thought she was too short. Nia Long got the gig instead. So I had to tell Jada, "Listen, I have to kiss your man in this movie." She gave me her blessings and told me to go for it. Just bring the banaka. Our big kissing scene was shot outside at night. Whew, it was bone-ass cold, and we were crying from the wind in our eyes. I didn't have to warn Jada, because it was the furthest thing from sexy. We kiss, 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 wipe the snot away, spray the banaka. Kiss, 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 wipe the snot away, spray the banaka. We ended up winning Best Kiss at the MTV Movie Awards. Will also helped me plan the next step in my career. Set it off. The director, F. Gary Gray, was friends with Will and came to visit the Independence Day set. Jada Pinkett had already been cast, and I had grown so close to Will and Jada that Gary saw me coming on the film, you know, as a family thing. He was so young, 25, and wanted to make sure he worked with people he liked. He said to me, "Yo, I've got this movie." He told me he wanted me for Frankie, the bank teller who gets fired from her job after having a gun held to her head during a robbery. She grew up in the projects with the robber, and so the bank wrongly accuses her of being in collusion. Fed up, she begins robbing banks with three girlfriends. But the studio wants Rosie Perez for Frankie. My face fell. Rosie was so talented and had been nominated for an Oscar for Fearless. He asked if I could audition for Titi, the sweet new mom, but also come in ready to read for Frankie. Will had read Jada's script, and as soon as I told him about the double audition, he was clear about my game plan. "You can do TT, but really got to get Frankie," he said. "You got to go in there and take that shit. Take what should be yours." He started slamming his fist in his hand like a motivational speaker, which, in that moment, he was. He knew Frankie's story was the biggest in the film because she was who the viewer would identify with as she responded to having her back against the wall. And he also knew people saw me as just the pretty girl. A glamour girl is limited because she doesn't get to do the gritty part. They didn't know I was Angie Fox who grew up by the projects. "You got to go in there and be pretty and be a bank teller and be professional," he said. "But when they do you wrong, you got to bring it, Viv. Your main note is that you want revenge." I auditioned on a lunch break, and I got the part. Gary told me when I said Frankie's lines, he was like, "Where did Vivica go?" I will always love Will for coaching me to be my best. I got to bond with those ladies on the film. Queen Latifah, who still calls me Big V, Jada, and Kimberly Elise. We rehearsed and rehearsed and became as tight as our characters were in the film. To make our friendship believable on screen, Gary wanted us to hang out and chill off the set, do the things that our characters do together so that we had an ease and history with each other that would translate to the screen. We were all nuts about each other right away. Kimberly was from the theater and was so quiet but so talented. She had a young child of her own, so the main ones who hang out all the time were me, Jada, and Latifah. The funny thing is that Jada was such a hip-hop head as a teenager in Baltimore that she worked in a club where Latifah did an appearance. Jada hadn't even heard her music yet, but was so hungry for female role models that when she saw a photo of Latifah, she demanded that she be the MC and introduce Latifah that night. Meanwhile, Latifah was so young, she had her mom with her. Two kindred spirits recognizing that drive early. I introduced Latifah to sushi when we were downtown and the only place that was open was a sushi spot. "Girl, I'm from the East Coast," she told me flat out, putting on her Newark accent as thick as possible. "We don't be eating no raw stuff." "Girl, you don't have to eat everything raw," I said, coming back at her full indie. "I got you. If I'm paying for that food, they better cook it." Sure enough, she loved it. "Wow, this is good," she said. To this day, when we meet up for a meal, we have sushi to commemorate our start. As I got closer to Jada, I had a front row seat to watching Will court her. Will approached it like he did everything that was important to him. He was not playing and was putting it down. Every week during the course of Set It Off, there was an escalation. First, it was 1,000 roses in her dressing room. Then, it was a Marquise diamond necklace. By the end, it was a convertible Mercedes. He was saying to her and everyone around, "You are the one. You are the one." I can't talk about Jada without paying tribute to her as a mother. I watched how having two gorgeous, interesting, smart children, Willow and Jaden, transformed her. She became regal. When she speaks to those kids, she reminds me of my teacher, Mrs. Fletcher. The one who sees every conversation as an opportunity to teach and learn. The biggest lesson Jada gave me was when I was rushing through lines on the set. I had gotten used to soap acting, where time is everything and you just have to get it done. We were rehearsing, and a scene just wasn't gelling for me. "Do you realize why you're not getting what you want?" she asked me. I hadn't thought of it that way. I was just plowing through, saying the lines. "Take your moment," she said. "Let the emotion happen for you, V." She was right. I still do that now. I do a lot of work to get into character before the camera starts rolling or I walk on stage. I create backstory and develop mannerisms. If my character has a certain job, whether I'm playing a beauty blogger or the president of the United States, I'm all over YouTube watching videos of people who do that to get their cadence of how they speak and the carriage of their bodies. All that preparation creates the bones of the character, but I still have to breathe life into it. Take my moment. Let the emotion come in so I can feel it and be authentic as I tell the story. Gary was one of the best directors I'd ever worked with. He had a strong, clear vision of what he wanted and demanded excellence. One time during filming, we all went to lunch and came back. I swear, 2 minutes late. Whoo! Gary let us have it. "Y'all late," he said. "I care about being on time. It's one of my things." "Still," I said, "we're hardly late." "Y'all got to understand, I'm serious about this movie," said Gary. "People are going to come to the theater thinking they're going to laugh at y'all women. We got to make it work. We are making a classic." He was tough. But the thing that made him so great as a director and a boss was that he would bend if the idea merited it. I had ad-libbed a line during my audition, and it wasn't in the script when it came time to shooting. It was when Frankie, shell-shocked from the robbery, is interrogated by the police about knowing the robber. Meanwhile, she is covered in blood from seeing a woman get shot in the head. The script said there were two detectives, one a black woman and the other a white man who does all the talking. I thought, even though it's the police, there has to be one woman-to-woman moment there. As Frankie leaves, trying to hold her head high, I pause to the black detective, played by Ella Joyce. You didn't even bother to ask me if I was thirsty, sister. It didn't make it into the shooting script, and I asked Gary if I could try the line for the film. Give me one, I said. Can you give me just one? That's the thing. Give a director or boss what they think they need, and then you can say, hey, can I have this take for me? If you show up prepared, knowing your lines and allowing everyone to work efficiently, that structure you have helped create gives you freedom. Once you give them what they need, you allow them the opportunity to say, sure, go for it. We did the second take, and that's the one he used. He told me that when he saw it in the editing room, he threw up his hands and yelled, this child right there? The dumbest thing to do is to walk in new and just say, I know what will work. Turn off number one. I know better. The last 6 of the 9 weeks of shooting were filmed at night. I decided we had all become vampires. It took a bit for our sleep schedules to get back on track, but it was so worth it. Set It Off helped me show that I wasn't only a glamour girl standing next to the hero. I'll wait here while you save me. You see Frankie make a transition. When the chips are down, becoming completely hood while maintaining her strength and her integrity. I'll never forget running into Dominique Wilkins during All-Star Weekend after Set It Off came out. Here was this basketball legend, without a question, one of the greatest dunkers in NBA history, running up to me. Vivica! What's up, Neek? Vivica, Set It Off. What about it? Yo, I had to go see that shit 2 days in a row, he said. I was crying. That movie was good as hell. I still have grown men coming up to me saying that Frankie made them cry. That year was a lesson in diversifying. Independence Day had a $60 million budget and a huge marketing campaign. Set It Off had $9 million and word of mouth. I am so proud that all of those actresses are still doing incredible work today and that Gary went on to be handed the keys to the Fast and the Furious mega franchise. The film showed my different strengths. I have said time and again that for me, my versatility has equaled my longevity. You can't get typecast in life. If I had stayed the glamour girl, who was going to hire me when Hollywood said I was too old for those roles? There is a shelf life for certain chapters in your life, especially in entertainment. If you learn how to go into each chapter gracefully, then you can extend the longevity of your career. Because so many people hold on to being that young, hot chick, and you're like, girl, let it go. You no longer can do that. You need a second act. I ask them what I ask myself. What you got next, bitch? So what have you got to keep you from getting typecast in life? How are you diversifying? Let's go through some quicksand scenarios that might be keeping you from moving forward and reaching your real goals. Number one, your job won't let you grow. People get used to seeing you in a certain way, and those perceptions get stuck. And then you and your career get stuck. If you're Judy in accounting, but you want to be president of the company, you need to show that you can do more than what's expected. You're Judy in accounting, they might as well say in your always positive employee evaluations. We will never promote you because what would we do if we didn't have you in accounting? Ah, but if they outsource the work and close her department, they would certainly figure out what to do without Judy in accounting. In my world, it's why I prefer to do a movie over a television series. With TV, a studio can pull the plug on you at any moment, or put you on Saturday nights at 9:30, then say, ratings are down, sorry. There's really no security. When you do a film, you've got a schedule and you've got your cast and crew. It's rare at that point they'll say, everyone go home. They've invested the money, they want a return, and box office receipts don't lie. So I would tell Judy to show that her skill set goes beyond what she's already doing. Make it clear in those evaluations that she wants a different role and can do new things. And privately, I would tell Judy to prepare to do those things elsewhere if she can't achieve her goals at her current job. Number two, you've been bought. I love money. I'm not stupid, but I love what it can do. I love the freedom it gives me to sometimes take risks, but mostly I love how it enables me to take parts I want. On some sets, the routine is, may I bring a cafe mocha to your trailer, Miss Fox? Other movies are like, coffee's over there. I think there's some left. I do a cost-benefit analysis. If it's work that I wake up excited to do or that will open up bigger opportunities for me in acting, it is worth the investment of my time. What is your cost-benefit analysis? Does your job pay so much simply because it sucks? Are you on your phone 24/7, thinking about work with dread when you're trying to sleep, or answering emails when you're at the playground with your kid? Times have changed, and I know that's a reality for many people in the workforce. But if all that effort is just making your boss super rich and you kind of sort of rich, then you should examine that. If you worked out the by-the-minute charges, perhaps you would be happier making less money but having more time for yourself, or working just as hard, even harder, on something that was yours. I know the pressures of being a provider, but it's your life and your dreams. Talk to the people you're supporting, especially your spouse, and tell them how much more you could be for them if you were working toward a real goal. Enlist them in the enterprise. Otherwise, you might resent them for making you work at a job you hate, and they will have no idea they're the reason. Number three, you're afraid to try. You are comfortable in the chair you're in. Nobody else is after it, I bet. You can practically do what you do in your sleep, day in and day out. Perhaps you mentor young people at your job, then watch them rise in the ranks, past you. While you keep doing what you're doing, you're pulling a paycheck, you eat at your desk, you're fine, but you're not. If you're not in love with your job, you are going through the motions. I did stand-in work when I was starting out. That means you literally stand in for a busier actress that you resemble so they can light you, block out the scene, and have it ready for the real star. I did that for Jasmine Guy when she was guesting on Fresh Prince. I could have settled for that and had fun stories from a studio set, but I wanted to be the real star. Just as I kept auditioning, I advise you to keep your interviewing skills sharp by going out for new jobs. Devote one day to your resume. Screw laundry. Sorry, it'll be there. Just do it and have a trusted friend look at it because you want to get it right. It's so easy these days to apply for jobs on sites like Indeed.com. The downside is that you are one of many, so you have to really bring it when you land an interview. People don't believe me now because it's such a classic romantic comedy, but I turned down the Two Can Play That Game script 3 times. It was a battle of the sexes kind of thing. My character, Shantae Smith, was the lead, and she was such a bitch. You were supposed to root for her to win back this guy, but what you really wanted to do was to tell him to run away. I also felt this was a missed opportunity to show sisterhood with Shantae's girlfriends. This had to be real, because a woman knows her girlfriends can sometimes be everything to her. This just wasn't the image I wanted to portray for my first time as lead in a movie. So I was straight with the director, Mark Brown. Look, until y'all write it so it's something I can be proud of, I'm cool where I'm at. I didn't settle, because I knew it was a good idea with the potential to be great. Mark just needed to work on it. So he went back and made the character stronger and more likable and believable. Because you have to really think that each thinks the other is worthy of compromise. Because that's what true love is. Each person deep down thinks they're getting the better end of the deal. Right? In the end, Shantae became much more real. A lot like me, in fact. She's an advertising exec who is sophisticated, but she can still be your girl from around the way. What I loved about the film was that it showed a side of the African-American community that wasn't seen on screen at the time. the upper middle class brothers and sisters who liked the finer things. If a brother or sister had money in movies back then, he was a drug kingpin or it was a joke. Isn't it weird that this black person has money? Not this movie. Shantae lives in a beautiful home, dresses to the nines, and drives a convertible Jaguar. As Shantae puts it, if you haven't noticed, I'm a sister. An educated, strong sister who remembers where she came from and knows where she's going. It said to the audience, yes, this exists, and yes, this is possible for you too. And frankly, it helped the brand of Vivica Fox. You saw a beautifully dressed woman who works hard, and you wanted to hang out with her. I had such a vision of Shantae that me and the woman in wardrobe sometimes had, disagreements. My outfit in the opening scene was crucial. It had to be killer, because there's a long walk through Shantae's office that establishes her power in the firm and also shows men reacting to my, assets. I take a springtime drive, and when I get out of the car, I have to keep the viewer's eye as I do a monologue about her life and men. I want it to just pop on the screen. And if I had to pay for the outfit myself, I had no problem getting out my brand new Amex. I was out shopping with my friend Cassandra Mills, this gorgeous entertainment executive, and I was telling her about the scene. "What color's the car?" she asked. "A dark red," I said. "Think yellow," she said. "Like ketchup and mustard," I said. "Of course, a classic contrast." Armed with my Amex, she and I went on a hunt. We found this Easter yellow Versace power pantsuit that was just slamming when I tried it on. "Get that tailor," she said. "Bring it in on the booty, and that'll be the one." "Charge it," I yelled. Once it fit like a second skin, the suit completely made the scene. Style is a weapon in Shantae's arsenal, so I had to make sure it was perfection. Morris Chestnut defined perfection as Shantae's love interest and opponent, Keith. Lord, I knew Morris from Out All Night days. He was a kid then, playing video games, nobody's hunk. But now, he was this man. We had kissing scenes. That was the only time that I ever lost myself in kissing another actor. He was that good. I damn near forgot the cameras were rolling. Hands down, the best kisser I ever had on screen. But don't worry, you know Vivica always keeps things professional. I like to tell people, I kiss Morris Chestnut for all the ladies. I still had one problem with the script, and I was really irritated about it. Shantae constantly breaks the fourth wall, talking to the audience and giving the real skinny on what's actually happening beneath the dialogue. I picture the audience screaming at me, "Turn around and act, bitch! Stop talking so much! Don't you know you in the movie?" I kept mentioning this to Mark, who was really good about listening to me. Finally, a producer on the film had enough. "Vivica, just go rent Ferris Bueller's Day Off," he said. "He does it really well." I listened and did my homework, thank God. Watching Matthew Broderick was a revelation. The voice didn't have to be all-knowing, but conspiratorial and just honest. From my first words to the viewer and, "Oh, hey, like you just walked into the scene and I need to catch you up and we're best friends." After watching Ferris, I apologized for not understanding earlier. "I got it now," I said. When you receive constructive criticism and it helps you deliver, you have to acknowledge it. I love my girls in that movie. Tamla Jones, Wendy Raquel Robinson, and Monique. Monique was a wonder, let me tell you. She was one of the last people cast, playing my fashionista friend. The role was originally supposed to be Tyra Banks, and Monique just loved that she was this big, beautiful woman who was completely believable as my most fashionable friend. She told me her agent had called her on a Friday and said, "There's a Vivica Fox movie starting Monday. Are you in?" She said yes without reading the script, and she's so funny in the film. She had a gift for making the friendship seem so real on screen. There's a party scene where Morris is dancing up on some women, trying to make me jealous. The three girls are like a Greek chorus with the rising crescendo of each saying, "What you gonna do, Shantae?" Well, she improvised, "What you gonna do, bitch?" Mark, the director, jump in. No, he said. They're friends. She can't call you bitch. There was a pause, and I just took him aside. Mark, that's Shantae's girl, I said. Sure, she can call me bitch. This is really how girls speak to each other when it's just them. It's like a term of affection. There was someone who always called me bitch around that time, and I loved her for it. Miss Whitney Houston. Her then-husband, Bobby Brown, had landed a small role in Two Can Play That Game. Whitney called me just before shooting started. Bitch, you better look out for my boy, she said. You know it, I said. I got you. We connected because our images in magazines were like ice princesses. Black Barbies. But we knew the truth. She had that jersey in her, and I grew up two blocks from the projects, so we could hang. One night after filming, she called me. Hey, what are you doing? She said. You want to go out? Girl, I'm just in a warm-up suit. Oh, don't worry. I'm casual, too. So we decided to meet at the Bel Air Hotel. As my friend Darren Bond and I were pulling up, there was Whitney, standing like a true star. Girlfriend had on an $85,000 full-length sable coat. Casual, I yelled. Casual? Oh, this? She laughed, that huge, amazing laugh of hers. I got my jeans on. We had some drinks at the bar, and then we got someone to round up a deck of cards, headed to her room, and we played spades for hours. As we talked, we of course got to what music we loved. We started doing Sade songs together, like No Ordinary Love and Smooth Operator. Whitney was a human being who wanted to live, to love, and to have that private time. To sing just for herself and not always be a singing doll in a little glass case. When it becomes boring and too much pressure, people rebel. You're like, I don't want to be perfect today. I have a portrait of her in my bedroom that I wake up to every day, and she is smiling because that's how I want to remember her. Two Can Play That Game opened September 7, 2001. We premiered at the old Cineplex Odeon in Century City, and I got out of the limo and saw starring Vivica A. Fox on the marquee. It was the best feeling in the world. The movie made more than its budget back in the first weekend, and I was set to go on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno that Tuesday. Then, of course, 9/11 happened, and there were more important things to worry about. But people are still discovering the film because Mark put in the effort to make it great. When a girl comes up to me with a big knowing smile, I know she is either going to be telling me about Two Can Play That Game or my wigs. They told me I had 15 minutes with Quentin Tarantino. Quentin's going to meet you in a coffee shop, my agent said. A coffee shop? It's to see whether or not he likes you, she said. Then he'll let you know if he wants to see you for the part. I thought, that's some shit, but okay. He'd written a role for a black woman in Kill Bill, a script that was already getting so much buzz. Vernita Green was a cold-blooded assassin hiding out in the suburbs of Pasadena until Uma Thurman comes to get hers. Oh, I was so anxious when I got to that coffee shop. It was like an audition for an audition. The first thing he told me was that he was in a video store and saw my name on the cover of the Two Can Play That Game DVD. I was like, Vivica Fox, he said, shouting my name like I already was an action hero. I'm going to take this home, and if she moves me on the screen, that's who's going to play my Vernita Green. Quentin loves telling stories, and if he likes you, oh, he is going to talk at, like, Mach 5. We discussed favorite movies, of course, talked about Pam Grier and how much I loved her, and Richard Roundtree, who played my dad on Generations. Yeah, I'm Shaft's daughter, I joked. The 15-minute meeting stretched out to an hour and a half until he said, I'm going to send you a scene and I'm going to come to your house and we'll work through it together. My house? Yeah. Promise me you won't hold my house against me. What are you talking about? Just promise me, Quentin. He did, and I'm sure he suspected I was a hoarder or some crazy person living in a tiny house. The truth was that I was living in a huge 8,000-square-foot mansion in Tarzana. I'd invested in real estate and was doing very well, thank you. And this place, frankly, looked like a diva lived there. It was straight out of Dynasty, with a double staircase and a huge chandelier right when you walked in. It could easily be mistaken for the home of a spoiled brat who would never follow direction. This was a time in film when studios were not playing. They were tired of problem actors and had dealt with their spoiled stars shutting down productions because of heroin problems. They wanted workers on the straight and narrow, and any red flags could put me out of the running. I was afraid he would take one look at the place and say, "Here, I thought Vivica was hungry." I still was. So when I answered the door, his greeting was, "Holy shit, is this your house? You promised me you wouldn't hold it against me." "Holy shit," he said again. "I'm not. Let me see this place." Before I could say anything, he helped himself to a tour like he was scouting a location. When he was done, he said he wanted to do the scene in the kitchen, just like in the film. He made me read it twice, and then, like he was making an idle remark, he said, "Very good. You are my Vernita Green. I'm hungry. Do you want sushi?" We went out to Kushiyu on Ventura and Tarzana. At dinner, he told me his plan for the film. There would be no quick cuts or getting away with special effects to make us look like real warriors. I had to commit to 6 months of training, and all of the actors needed to become experts in martial arts to make his vision real on the screen. "No problem," I said, thinking back to my high school athlete days. "Piece of cake." "Ha." For 3 months, Uma Thurman, Lucy Liu, Daryl Hannah, David Carradine, and I spent 8 hours a day studying martial arts at a gym they put together in Culver City. It was 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. If you didn't walk in the door between 8:55 and 8:59, you were in trouble by 9:01. I thought I was in the damn Olympics or something. Uma was 3 months out from having her gorgeous baby boy, Rowan, and she also brought her equally beautiful 4-year-old, Maya, along. Of all the girls on the set, I think Uma liked me best because of her kids. I used to play with them all the time. That baby boy would stare into my eyes. "Vivica," she said one day, "I think he's in love." She and I were on strict diets. So, while continuing our training in China, we had a ritual of spending our one cheat day a week hanging out at this bowling alley Maya loved. We'd eat slice after slice of cheap pizza, loving every bit of it. At first, Uma was frustrated because all the other women on the film were dropping weight so quickly with the intense training. I mean, the woman had just had a child. "Don't worry," I said. "It'll come off." She went to Tokyo to film for a month. And when I saw her again, I walked right past her. She yelled, "Hey, Vivica." I was like, "Damn, you got skinny?" Uma needed all the support she could get. The movie rested on her shoulders. Oh, she was so busy. And then her and Daryl had that blonde competition thing going on. And I was like, "I'm gonna be cool with you. I'm gonna be cool with everybody. I'm not in a pissing contest." I have to tell you, whether you're on a movie set or working at a law firm, some people will try to pull you into their drama and make you pick sides. Don't fall for it. Think for yourself and stay above the fray. Drama aside, the training itself was brutal. We do fight choreography, knife throwing, samurai lessons, and hit the treadmill and weights in between. They liked me because I could do them high kicks from being a cheerleader. And every Friday, at the end of the day, Quentin would gather us around and give us a review. He called it his State of the Union. We all had to sit and listen. The first week, Quentin cut into us, telling us we had to work harder. "Okay, I can work harder." Second week, we got the same thing after we busted our asses. He said we weren't giving it our all. Third Friday, I was so proud of all that our team had accomplished. I was sitting between cute little Lucy and sweet Uma, and I was ready for a high five for all of us. Instead, Quentin tore into us, something about lollygagging in the morning, taking too long to suit up, and gabbing over coffee. He said we should get here at 8:30, a half hour early, if we wanted to do all that. I raised my hand. "Hold up. I lost it on him. Is this a beat-us-up contest, I asked? Are we fucking doing anything right? Goddamn! Everyone gasped. I felt Uma draw back. Lucy grabbed my hand and was trying to do some kind of acupressure on me, whispering, calm down, calm down. I couldn't. I kept sputtering, thinking I was taking a stand for everyone. And finally, Quentin sort of said he appreciated the work, but he wanted us to all do our best and to trust him. Uma came up to me after. Come here, she said. She put her arm on my shoulder, and those beautiful eyes of hers locked on mine. You know, Uma, it's bullshit, I said. She repeated in her calm, meditative voice. I've worked with him, I've worked with him. I've worked with him, and it's how he does things. He doesn't mean anything by it. It's just how he gets down. Well, God, I sputtered. I mean, we're working our fucking asses off. And it's like, you know, like we're not doing anything right. What you need to do is learn how to manipulate the situation better. Then you can get what you want. I was all righteous. I don't have to manipulate nobody, I said. That's not me. I don't have to kiss his ass. She cocked her head. No, I didn't mean like that, she said, still speaking in that calm, soothing voice. You have to learn to be quiet. Speak less. He's tough, but he's not stupid. He'll concede you something if it makes the film better. Learn to attack intelligently, Vivica, because he's got the power to fire you. And she told me she didn't want that to happen. But thank you for speaking up, she said. That moment was pure sisterhood. She was honestly looking out for me. She wanted me to advocate for myself, but to do it in a way that was more constructive. I'll admit, it still took me a minute to figure out what she was talking about. I was driving home from Culver City when I realized why she had touched me so deeply. I thought about my dad, and when he would tell me not to just go off on the basketball court, when all my energy had me spazzing out. Attack intelligently, he would tell me the exact same words Uma used. Don't blow it by blowing up. When it came time for real rehearsals and filming, I got to see Uma give a masterclass in being a movie star and leader on the set. I'd watch her argue with Quentin intelligently and successfully for wardrobe changes and even dialogue rewrites. She made it a true collaboration, pushing him away from simply making an ode to the samurai films he made us all watch with him towards something new. Kill Bill is an astonishing work because of their shared efforts, and it's because they each approached it not as a job, but as a cornerstone of their careers. I know it's the work that I'm most proud of in my career. It took 4 days to film our fight scene, and the last day, I took a long bath when it was over. I sat in the tub and counted all the bruises on my arms and legs. I got up to 30, and I did so with gratitude. I was proud of my battle scars. I had done a Tarantino film, and nobody could take that accomplishment away from me. Quentin is a fabulous director, and I'd love to work with him again. I appreciate those endless hours in the Culver City torture chamber. It was his way of breaking us down to build us back up. From Uma, I learned so much about sharing power. She wanted me to do my best. This hasn't always been the case for black actresses in film. I think the dirty secret of why African-American actresses are only now getting more opportunities is that directors were afraid to put a sister against a white actress because they knew the sister who had to work her ass off to get to that moment was always going to shine like the brightest light and blow the white actress off the screen. I say, put me with the best, because if she's bringing her A game, I'm bringing my A-plus game, and we're going to turn this mother out. Part 2, Find Your Dream and Actually Make It Happen. Lesson 5, You Can't Aim If You Don't Have a Target. I just want to briefly address the reader who might be saying, shoot, I don't know what my dream is. Calm down. Let's figure it out together. I'm going to give you some exercises, and the only thing I ask is that you think big. Number one, make a list of jobs you wouldn't hate doing. I phrase it like that because sometimes when you're unhappy with where you are in life or facing a setback, it's hard to imagine liking work. So what wouldn't suck? Go as pie in the sky or far-fetched as you want. The list will tell you a lot about you. A friend of mine, Mary, had worked in the corporate litigation department of a law firm for about 6 years. She had been passed over for partner and wasn't sure if she even wanted to make partner anymore. She was miserable. One day after we talked on the phone, she wrote a list of about 10 jobs she wouldn't mind doing. Let's look at the pros and cons of just two from that list. Yoga instructor. Divorce lawyer. Examining each one revealed what she truly wanted in life. Her reasoning for considering being a yoga instructor seemed obvious to me because she goes every week. But as she talked to me later, her reasons become more detailed. I like helping people and making the connection, Mary said. I would save money on classes, obviously, but there's a teaching aspect to it that I like. As she imagined the scenario, she pictured her own studio. She didn't want to partner with an existing facility because she was tired of dealing with office politics and clearing everything with someone else. Going on her own meant finding a space and keeping it maintained, not to mention finding the students to fill it with. She would also need to be certified as an instructor to run a yoga school. That would take 200 hours of training and money for classes. It didn't seem like a return on her investment in law school or the hours she spent miserable in the law firm. I needed a return on all that time, she told me. When she thought about starting her own private practice as a divorce lawyer, she realized it provided some of the things she liked. She would be the boss and wouldn't have to answer to anyone. She would be helping people through a crisis, teaching them how to look out for themselves. And since she was already licensed as a lawyer, there was no more certification needed other than the continuing education that all lawyers have to do to maintain their bar status. Mary became a divorce attorney and recreated some of the aspects she liked working in a big firm. She works in a shared workspace with a host of other entrepreneurs who can book conference rooms to meet clients. She also uses an inexpensive call service to answer her phones, so that no matter what, the clients feel someone is working on their case. There are things I miss about firm life, she told me, like having support staff and not working so much on weekends. I'm always working now, but it's work I love. So let's go over her pros. Being her own boss, low overhead, no fee for certification, and don't forget, happiness. Number two, what makes you stick out? This is usually the thing that we initially think might be an obstacle, but turns out to be an asset. Growing up, I thought it was my name because it was so uncommon. Now people say Vivica, and you know who they're talking about. For Mary, it was that she was a woman in a law firm. She felt barred from the boys' clubs. Meetings had a funny way of continuing afterwards at the urinal, she said. Then I'd hear, "Oh, Bob said I should." Now, potential clients sometimes seek her out as a divorce attorney specifically because she is a woman. Some men want a woman to represent them in court as part of their strategy, and some women want to speak to someone they know understands them. Another way Mary sticks out is that she's a member of the LGBT community. With same-sex marriage comes same-sex divorce. She can genuinely market herself to that community and also feel good about being a real resource to them. Number three, ask people what your strengths are. I know it's hard, but just do it. I always tell the exceptional actors in my life, you're used to being you. They do all these great things that no one else can do, and it's become so ho-hum that people don't mention it. It becomes so that even they lose sight of what makes them such assets to the work. This isn't fishing for compliments from coworkers and friends. It's figuring out what you're actually good at and asking for examples of why they thought that. This list of strengths will reveal what you bring to the table and give you a script for how you present yourself in an interview or with a potential client. I'm a closer. Put me in a room, I can use my people skills to sell an idea. I have never missed a single deadline. I have a levity that can calm people down in high-pressure situations. Number 4. Make a vision board and tack a to-do list next to it. Anytime you see someone or something that inspires you professionally, tear it out or print it up and put it on your vision board. This isn't an afternoon activity with an excuse to buy magazines. This is an ongoing process of finding articles and images that speak to you as a worker bee. Next to that board, I need you to put a blank sheet of paper. And it cannot stay blank for long. This is where you will list the concrete, positive steps you are doing to get what's on that vision board. This has to be an everyday ritual. It's paying off a bill. It's contacting one of those people on your vision board and asking to shadow them or just talk on the phone. This is about doing the work, so make sure you're doing something you love. Since I'm asking you to think about what your dreams are, I need to tell you why acting is my dream job. Last night, I was in a stage play, and it reminded me why I love what I do. It was at the Philadelphia Merriam Theater, built nearly 100 years ago. This stage has hosted greats like Sammy Davis Jr., Katharine Hepburn, and Helen Hayes. They took the same breath I did before walking out, and maybe had the same butterflies I did. Yes. I still get butterflies from acting and from certain men. And there was the audience, ready to give me that immediate feedback of love. The butterflies go, and you get a warm feeling in the pit of your stomach. It really is that cliche of surprise every time. They like me. They really, really like me. But you got to do the work. You got to earn the applause. It's not just given. So hold for applause and then deliver. Last night was in front of a mostly black audience, and they're the best, because they'll let you know whether the show is working or whether it's not. Black audiences are part of the show, let me tell you. Oh, child, someone says, yes, get that bitch. Don't let that bitch in. There was one girl last night in the front row who really stood out. I thought she was going to climb up there to join me. During this big confrontation scene between me and the ex-wife of the lead, this pretty girl yelled, tell her, Vivica, tell her ass. Ooh, I can't with her. No, she ain't up there talking to my girl. When things like that happen, it takes all of my training to stay in character and not give her a smile or just flub my line. Forgetting your line is every actor's nightmare, but it happens to everyone. That's when you depend on your co-star. There were a couple of times last night where I knew we messed up, but you can't let it derail you. It's like troubleshooting any problem in business. Keep calm and carry on. If you kind of mess up a line, then just bring it back. One trick that I pass along to the actors I do stage plays with is that the audience is not sitting there with the script reading along. This is something I actually learned on Dancing with the Stars, of all places. I kept worrying about messing up a sequence of moves. They don't know the choreography, my dance partner and teacher Nick Kosovich told me. They will only know you messed up if you tell them. So don't tell them. Don't point out the slips that only you know you made. Doing a play is completely different from doing a film or TV show. With those, there's so much waiting. You're in and out of character, constantly being stopped for touch-ups or lighting tweaks. You listen to direction and get a few tries. You do it, and it's done. They're on film forever. On the plus side, so many people see it and discover it for years and years later. With a stage play, it's kind of like being pregnant. You're molding the story. On opening night, you're giving birth and hope the kid turns out to be a good kid. You got to get in there and do the work and plant the seeds and make sure that the lines work and that things are funny. I worry about wardrobe, makeup, lighting, the things that I normally don't have to worry about when I do TV. There, my job is to learn my lines and, well, act. The set is for somebody else to do, but I still pay attention so I know what works. Whether or not I'm a producer on the play, I'm such a stickler for detail. When I'm in a new theater, I make a point to go into the different parts of the audience to sit and see what they see. I need to know that everyone can see my movement, on how to hold my face so my reactions can be seen. Because there's no Bill, the camera guy, swooping in to get that shot. It has to be right there for the person who's put down money to watch me act. The tweaking doesn't stop. Last night we went long, which I had a feeling would happen, so we'll fix that. When you're actually on stage and it's real, you also have to start to clock stuff in the middle of things. Last night, on my way out of a scene, I saw that somebody forgot to take the little price tag off the lamp. So you know, I gotta go and get that today. I travel with stage plays, so it's kind of like an old-fashioned theater troupe hitting town. That's different from when you do location work for a film. Then it's like a sleepaway camp. There's tons more people, and the stars are all kind of forced to hang out together. When I starred as Listerine in the critically acclaimed Booty Call, I worked with the incredible Jamie Foxx. Back then, I knew he was so funny, but oh man, it was hard to be his dressing room neighbor for a few weeks. He had a piano in there, and he would just play it all the damn time, singing his pretty little heart out. One time, I was trying to take a nap between scenes, and I went out and screamed at him to stop playing that damn piano, not knowing, in less than 10 years, that he would be getting an Oscar for doing that and so much more in Ray. Getting to work with such talented people is amazing, but travel is also a major aspect to this being my dream job. I feel so blessed to go places that Angie from Indianapolis didn't even know existed. Doing boat trip with Cuba Gooding Jr. brought me to Santorini, Cologne, Israel, Egypt. Oh, it was just amazing. I did an action comedy with Eddie Griffin that you might have missed called Blast. It's the reason I got to go to South Africa for the first time. I distinctly remember looking out at Table Mountain in Cape Town and saying out loud to no one, "Oh my God, I love my life." Have I picked a film because of the location? Oh, hell yeah. So just as Mary listed her pros, I recognize that acting and producing channels all my gifts and loves. I like being on a team and collaborating as we tell stories I care about. I choose projects that reinforce and extend my personal brand. My OCD tendencies inform my work ethic, or my work ethic is informed by my OCD. It's a chicken or egg thing, and I get to pick up and leave, place someone else in some of the most magical places in the world. It's not enough to decide what you love. Start today on making your dream job happen, not tomorrow. I recently hosted a baby shower for one of my girlfriends in L.A. Oh, I love these kinds of events, because it's time for me to catch up with a lot of my friends all at once. There was this lady, and she just kind of kept looking at me. She was a white woman with brown hair and blonde highlights, probably about 35. Finally, I went over and introduced myself. "I'm so happy to meet you," she said in this sweet southern accent. "I wonder if I could get some advice from you." We sat down and talked. Her name was Colleen, and she told me she had recently moved here from Tennessee. She'd been in pharmaceutical sales and one day decided she wasn't happy. "I stopped my job," she said. "I went back to school and I got my MFA. I studied drama and theater." "Wow," I said. "It is so important that you studied." "I always tell people, you have to be able to do drama, comedy, and musicals. You need to be able to fit in all three." "I know it could be a little bit late for me," Colleen said, "but I want to be in a movie, even if it's just as an extra. I would be so happy. I want to do what you're doing." I guess she wanted me to say, "Sure, come to the set next week." I looked her right in the eye. "You've got to start somewhere," I said. "Don't say just an extra, because that is education. That will get you on a set, and you can see what actors really do. The work isn't just what's on screen. Because people just get to see the final version. You don't know that we actors stand on our feet for 12 hours a day. We get hustled through wardrobe changes before we lose the light. We have to learn so many lines and hit our marks and look good. Be ready to do a flip and a dip and a hair toss. Most people really don't understand what it is we do. I asked Colleen what she was doing to make things happen. She said, she just got here. Well, you can't just stand by.